Thanks for the nice introduction. And it's a great pleasure to be able to tell you a little bit about some work we've been doing with Omer Gerdigan, my student Andy Liu, Andrew McLeod, and Matthias Wilhelm. And we found a way to compute some things to high loop order in very brief. So we've been able to compute the scattering of six gluons in this special theory, planar n equals 4, through seven loops at the time. And there's a form factor of a local operator, which is actually similar to how the Higgs boson is produced at the LHC through gluon fusion. And we could compute a particular form factor, which involved three external gluons here to eight loops at the time. And then we just looked at the two results, and we saw that in some sense they were written backwards from each other, which is very surprising and stunning. Certainly stunned Jean one time when I gave this talk at KITV. but we still didn't have a great idea of what was going on. And we still don't have a terrific idea of what's going on, but the plot has thickened in some ways. So we kind of call this antipodal duality, because there's an antipode map involved, which I'll define in a little while. But it maps two different processes to each other. But now there's apparently a bigger relation we call antipodal self-duality. And so just in one transparency, what this is about is that there's another form factor which has one more leg, one more external particle, say a gluon, than the three-point form factor. And it has a duality where you map the process into itself. And it works in such a way that as you go to the appropriate boundaries of the phase space, in one limit, you get two gluons going collinear, and the appropriate quantity goes smoothly into the original, the earlier three-gluon form factor. And under that map, that region maps to a different region where three gluons go collinear, which actually is turns out to be equivalent to this six gluon amplitude, which I can try to explain a little later. So we validated this one. We originally discovered it at seven loops, and now we sort of used it, sort of validated it to eight loops. So it's pretty robust. This one we can get to about three loops so far, but we think it's pretty likely to hold, since on the boundary it works to eight loops. And so the rest of this talk is going to be kind of fleshing this out. What is this antipode I was mentioning, and things like that. Any questions so far? So I just wanted to mention that this operator we're studying in the form factor actually has a remarkably close correspondence with the operator used to make the Higgs boson at the LHC. And when you make the Higgs at the LHC, it doesn't talk directly to gluons. You have a huge number of gluons inside the proton just waiting to make a Higgs, but they have to go through a top quark loop. But the top quark is quite heavy compared to the mass of the Higgs, so it's a very good approximation to integrate it out and replace its effects at one loop with a local operator, which is the Higgs field coupled to the product of the two gluon field strengths. And if we want, this Higgs is kind of behaving trivially, so we could just refer to the operator as the product of the two gluon field strengths. So almost the same operator as the one we're going to look at in n equals 4 super Yang Mills. It's just we're going to take self-dual pieces of these field strengths when we do it. So that would be all you would have to do to calculate the leading order cross-section. But in fact, it's a really bad approximation. If you look here, this is the expression for the full short-distance cross-section. It's just a series in the strong coupling constant. And you can see the terms in the series evaluated here. This is the center of mass energy of the LHC, which is run at 7 and 8 and almost 14 TeV. And this is the leading order approximation. and some estimate of its uncertainty, which is really bad because the next order in the term, next order in the series puts you way up here, and then the one after that up here. And only once you've gone to about the third subleading order do you start to see these successive approximations converging. So in this particular case, QCD at the LHC, you need very high orders in order to get decent accuracy. But this N cubed LO calculation in the QCD contributions were done by Anastasio, Dürr, Dulat, Herzog, and Misselberger about 8 years ago. And when you combine them with a few other smaller corrections, you get these plots, and now you can put experimental data on it. And you see the experimental data from the lower energies at 7 and 8 TeV and also at 13 agree quite well with these predictions. So this is just to say that some of the motivation for doing high loop order computations in the QCD world really results in stunning agreement with experiment. If you want to go beyond leading order to go to those higher orders, you have to do a number of things. Just to go to the next order at NLO, one of the things you need to do is to exchange another gluon, and we call this the virtual correction to the glue-glue to Higgs process, or the Higgs form factor to two gluons. Those are the virtual corrections. But then you also have to allow for the possibility that along with your Higgs, you also produced another gluon, which you didn't necessarily observe. You produce Higgses inclusively. So you look for Higgses and you don't look for the other things, but you have to include them. And so this real radiation now introduces, at the lowest order, the three gluon form factor in a particular channel where two gluons are incoming and one gluon and the Higgs are outgoing. And this vertical line means that we interfere this amplitude with this amplitude. And here we square this amplitude. And these are just representative diagrams, of course. If you want to go to NNLO, you need three-loop virtual. You need two-loop with one radiation, like this three-point form factor. You need four-point form factors at one loop. And you also need trees with up to three additional gluons. And there are many other complications to really get those curves out that I showed. You need to include quark lines running through here, operator renormalization, higher order corrections in mTOP. But at the end of the day, you need these loop amplitudes or some version of them in order to do those calculations. So that's a motivation for being interested in scattering amplitudes, not just of pure gluons, which would be for jet physics, but also things involving operators because they are responsible for producing the Higgs. So the state of the art currently for this particular term in this series is actually two loops, although three is getting pretty close. But that's sort of the limit, around the limit of what you can do in QCD. And one of the issues is that when you go beyond tree level, not only do you have to draw all these diagrams and evaluate them, but you have to do integrations over all of the loop momenta. As an example, when you do this three gluon form factor at one loop, you encounter this Box-Feynman integral, which is just stands for the product of four propagators, one over p squareds for the appropriate momentum p. And if you work that out, omitting overall factors and stuff, you get these die logarithms. And the die logarithm is a particularly simple special function, which gets its name because you integrate a logarithm with a logarithmic measure. When you go beyond one loop, at one loop, there's a very nice property that in the vicinity of four dimensions, the one loop integrals always reduce to scalar box integrals plus simpler quantities. And because of that, the answer is always just some combination of die logarithms, where these x's may take on many different values depending on the kinematics of the process. But there's essentially one special function that you need on top of just the logarithm. But when we go to the multi-loop case, we get much more complicated sets of integrals. And somehow the best case is that we get something called generalized or multiple Pauli logarithms. At L loops, you get, as a result of doing these integrals, effectively like two L different integrations. And if you're lucky, each of the integrations has a specific form, which is the integral of a D log. Here we have the differential of the log of T minus A1, where A may depend on the external kinematics. And this gives us a recursive definition of a class of multiple polylogs called the G functions. So they have a stack of arguments in front here, A1 to AN, and N will be the weight, or the number of integrations involved. And they're defined recursively, so you take the case with one fewer index, one lower weight, and you integrate it with this D log to define the next one. There's also some special cases. This doesn't make sense if A1 is zero. So the cases with zeros, you just define them to be logarithms of X. Now, these functions have come under increasingly good control recently, but they're still pretty intricate. But they're an ingredient, and they can go a long ways just with these in another theory that is much simpler than QCD. So QCD is the theory relevant for predicting cross-sections at the LHC. By and large, they're dominated by QCD uncertainties. But there's another theory that shares a lot of properties with QCD, but in other ways it's much simpler, and that is planar N equals 4 Super Yang-Mills theory. So we can think of it as the hydrogen atom for scattering amplitudes. There are lots of very nice properties that it has, and we can solve things in much more detail than in QCD. But there are certain commonality with QCD. And this theory is obtained by taking the gauge group SU3 of QCD, generalizing the number of colors to be NC, and also adding super partners, fermions or gluinos and scalars, all in the adjoint representation, and we take the limit that the number of colors becomes very large, the so-called planar limit, because all the Feynman diagrams will be planar in the strict limit that NC goes to infinity. Now, the structure of these amplitudes as kinematic functions in any theory can be written as decomposed into products of rational functions of the kinematics and transcendental functions. And the QCD case, there are very complicated interplay between these, even at relatively low loop order. But in this theory, in planar N equals 4, the rational structure is very well understood. There are certain, at least for large classes of amplitudes, we know exactly what the rational prefactors are. And so we can take that into account and just focus on the transcendental functions. So I'm not even going to say anything about what the rational prefactors are, because in the case I'm considering, they are basically just the expression at tree level, a very simple expression, which we just divide out at the beginning. And then everything else is these transcendental functions. Also in this theory, there are at least three dualities that have been discovered. One of them is the ADS-CFT correspondence, which is the statement that this theory is secretly an ADS strings propagating on anti-de Sitter space. And in the case of scattering amplitudes, that actually leads to another picture in which amplitudes are dual to polygonal Wilson loops. And then we have this new duality and or self-duality, which is much less understood dynamically why it holds.
Max,
yeah.
Going back to your example for GCD.
Yeah.
For the extra gluon emission for mass production,
yeah,
you also have the extra dark pair and linear limit.
Yeah.
And so does, by upgrading it to like the supersymmetric case, does it control the IR combinations between those two contributions to make it like cleaner? Because in the case of the standard model, you have to add the quark ones, right?
Yeah. So if you were doing something analogous in N equals 4 super Yang Mills, instead of adding quarks, you would add gluinos in the adjoint.
Yeah, I get that.
It doesn't necessarily make the infrared behavior better.
Okay.
Also, in terms of the mathematical structure of the full cross section, that is not typically as well behaved as the behavior of the individual amplitudes. So it's a long song and dance, but all these amplitudes are individual and contributions individually here are all infrared divergent. Some because of virtual loops and some because of real phase space integrations. And then you can ask, do you see a massive simplification if you were to do a N equals 4 analog of this process? And the answer is, like, probably not as much. I don't know exactly for this case, but we looked at another example, like the energy-energy correlation has been studied in both QCD and N equals 4, and it's somewhat similar in spirit to this. So you don't see quite as much simplification. You get rational prefactors that are not controlled, like the ones are in the individual amplitude components. Any other questions? So for the amplitudes, but not necessarily the cross sections, there is a property of the weight, uniform weight, or sometimes called uniform transcendentality, that is obeyed for N equals 4 super Yang Mills. It's not exactly a proof, but there's overwhelming evidence. Every time you compute something at a given loop order, the part of the amplitude that is not divergent, that has no powers of the regulator epsilon in dim reg, that answer always has transcendentality 2L at loop order L. And this weight is the number of integrations, as I was mentioning before. And a logarithm is a single integration of a D-log form, so that always counts as one. And then at one loop, you get weight two, you get dilogarithms, which are these integrals of a D-log with another log. If you integrated the same D-log again, you would get log squared. And so that's basically the limit at one loop. But then you can get higher weight things. I mentioned these G-functions. A small subspace of those G functions are the classical polylogs, and they can be defined by integrating the previous classical polylog, LIN minus 1, with a D log, DT over T. And you can get up to weight N that way. So in the N equals 4 case, you get to pick out just functions of weight 2L. Whereas in the QCD case, you will typically get all weights from 2L down to 0. Including rational terms. So that's one of the reasons why these guys are much more complicated. So there's a really nice process that we were able to look at recently, which is this Higgs to 3 gluon form factor, which could be in the channel glue-glue to Higgs glue. And this was investigated about over a decade ago, and the QCD result, not counting this top quark loop, which was integrated out to be a local operator, the QCD state of the art is two loops. And so that involves diagrams like this, and it was computed by Guermon and company in 2011. Now, recently, there has been quite a bit of progress on the integrals that you would need to go to three loops, where you have three massless legs and one massive leg. For example, these sets of papers, but it hasn't quite been assembled into the full results just yet. In contrast, when we switch the theory to planar N equals 4, we can go not just to three loops, but all the way up to eight loops. And it's kind of remarkable that all of these amplitudes live in a very simple function space, which is part of what allows us to get to this order. And this operator here, instead of being the product of just the two gluon field strengths, you need to take the self-dual part, so the gluon field strength minus its dual, squared, and that gives us that's the operator that we use. It's also in a multiplet with the called the chiral stress tensor multiplet. So this process is nice and simple because it has relatively few kinematic variables, but it has more. It has some non-trivial kinematic dependence, which helps to do it. Now I just want to show you as a teaser the some of the results. And to show you the results, I'm not going to show them to you as a function of the, there are two kinematic variables in the process, but we're going to go down onto a one-dimensional line. And when we go onto the one-dimensional line, these g functions collapse so that all the a sub I indices are just 0 and 1. And those were actually given a name by physicists Remedy and Vermazarin called harmonic polylogs. And so they're defined by iterated integration, somewhat similar to the classical polylogs, except that you have two options at each point. You can integrate the previous guy dt over t or dt over 1 minus t up to x. And to record which one you keep, you put in a binary bit in the front. So if you integrate dt over t or t minus 0, you put a 0 in the front. If you integrate dt over 1 minus t, you put a 1 in the front. So these W's are just binary strings. And the number of elements in the string, the weight, is the weight, and it's twice the loop order. And later we'll define the symbol, and it turns out that because of this, there's a binary set of letters in the symbol in this case, just two letters, x and 1 minus x. And interestingly, the branch cuts are all dictated by the first entry that you do, which is actually the last one in the W string. And the derivatives are indicated by the last entry of the symbol or the first entry in this string. So there's a different role played by the beginning and the end of the order of integration. So now I just want to show you the first three loops worth of the eight loop form factor that we computed. When we take the kinematical variables, which are ratios of the gluon invariants, S1, S2, S2, S3, and S3, S1, divided by S1, 2, 3. S1, 2, 3 is also the operator momentum squared. So there are three dimensionless ratios, but because of momentum conservation, this one is not independent. It's just W here is 1 minus U minus V. So things generically depend on U and V. And to simplify it even further, we're going to take V to infinity. And when we do that, we find that actually at leading power, V drops out completely, and we just get harmonic polylogs in an argument that depends on U, and the best argument to use is 1 minus 1 over U. And then you see you get a string of these answers that are these harmonic polylogs with binary codes. It always starts with 0 and ends with 1, and that's something that happens to all loop orders. By the time we get to eight loops, we have 16,384 terms worth in this smaller representation of a limiting behavior. So we computed this in planar n equals 4 only a couple of years ago, but even earlier than that, we had done the 6 gluon amplitude in this theory, and it depends on three variables in principle. But there was a kind of natural line to go look at where we set two of the cross of the underlying variables to become equal to each other and one of them equal to 1. And then we had used this argument, 1 minus 1 over v hat. And then we had this set of results here. But then at some point, both files appear open at the same time, and you kind of look at them and you see that all the numbers are the same, at least the ones ignoring the zeta values. So you see here there's a 96H0 with a bunch of ones and then a 1. And then back here there's the same thing, except all these zeros have been swapped with ones. So it turns out that you could map these two expressions exactly equal to each other if you ignore the zetas and you set 1 over v hat to 1 minus 1 over u, which effectively swaps zeros and ones, but then you have to reverse the order of all the HPL indices. So this prescription we could just check it because we had both expressions to seven loops at the time, and over 4,000 terms had exactly the right coefficients to work. And then we realized that this was a one-dimensional line that could be extended to the whole two-dimensional kinematics of the three gluon form factor. So any questions about this part, though, before we go on to that? Yep.
So this is all with the operator, which is the self-dual gluon.
Yeah.
So what breaks, what has the complexity of your view, like, just to the normal fluid stream?
Well,
what's going right?
There's a lot of commonality between the two. The if you include the self-dual part, then the original operator only makes states of gluons initially of one chirality. So a Higgs, a normal Higgs, goes into plus plus, and the amplitude is the same as going to minus minus, because parity is conserved, and those states are related by parity. Now, this operator only makes one of the two. Let's say it makes minus minus. So it doesn't make plus plus at all. You could also use this operator in QCD, and then you would actually get plus plus, but only at the loop level, not at the tree level. But in terms of the complexity, it's not a whole lot different, but one of the things you have to watch out for is the renormalization of the operator. And this one is BPS and protected to not have any anomalous dimension. Once you put it in an anomalous dimension, you have typically breaking of the uniform transcendentality because of divergences. The beta function in QCD, for example, is a sort of 1/ε pole times a rational number. Whereas to keep the transcendentality right, it should be 1/ε times the logarithm. So you can run into some troubles like that. They're not huge, and these things are closely related. And in fact, if you take this operator and you compare the expressions with the QCD ones, at the level of the leading transcendental parts through two loops, they agree. So there's this maximal transcendentality principle. But you may get more subleading terms if you work with the gluon field strength squared. There are other operators around too, and recently we've been playing with sort of the product of three field strength, self-dual field strengths contracted up in a cycle. And that also lives in a similar space of functions. So these amplitudes here, I just flashed some values on one particular line, but I didn't even explain much of anything about the kinematics. So let me just say a little bit about the kinematics. When you have no operator and you just have gluons, as I was mentioning, there's a duality that was discovered a while ago between amplitudes and Wilson loops. In planar n equals 4, instead of calculating Feynman diagrams with external lines that go off to infinity, like incoming and outgoing gluon plane waves, you can actually calculate instead a correlator that is in a kind of a position space in a dual space-time, where you would attach gluons to the edges of this polygon, because this is a path-ordered exponential on this polygonal contour. And the edges here are light-like, and they correspond to the momentum vectors over here. So the coordinates are called dual momenta, xi, and the differences of adjacent coordinates, xi minus I plus 1, are identified with these momenta. And so they're null vectors, because the gluons are taken to be on shell k squared equals 0. So this interpretation of the amplitude as a Wilson loop tells you that you should have an extra symmetry, a conformal symmetry that acts on these x's. And that symmetry also holds then on the amplitude side. and it reduces the number of kinematic variables that you have by 4 or 5. So there's a map that's part of this so-called dual conformal symmetry group that takes a coordinate x and inverts it by replacing it by x over xi squared. And then these intervals, xi minus xj squared, they go into themselves, but up to these factors. So if you want an expression to be invariant under this symmetry, you need to form these invariant cross ratios involving an xi minus xj squared in the numerator, and same for k and l, and then swap the role of j and k in the denominator. And now these xi j squareds, they're differences of corners, but those are also sums of adjacent momenta. And so they can be rewritten in terms of Mandelstam variables. In the six-point case, the only Mandelstams you have are two-particle invariants and three-particle invariants. In the 4 and 5-point case, the reason why we don't bother looking at them is that there actually aren't any such variables. The constraint that adjacent vertices are null separated means you can't put x12 squared in the numerator. And restrictions like that lead to there not being any dual conformal invariants until you get to the 6-point case. Once you get to the 6-point case, you can draw this hexagon and you can put in x13 in the numerator here, x46 over here, and then divide by these diagonals, and that will be a dual conformal invariant. And if you work out the definitions here, you'll see it has a two-particle invariant here, which is the sum of the square of k1 and k2, and similarly on this side. And then the denominators are the sums of squares of three-particle invariants. So we call this one u hat, and we call it u hat because we're going to use u for the form factor and u hat for the six gluon amplitude. So for n equals 6, we get precisely three ratios. We get the one u hat shown here, and the only other ones you can make are ones that are cyclically related. So you have a sort of cyclic triplet of variables in the six gluon case. There's a sort of broader program which we can embed this into. I'm just showing you one slice, one process, or two processes, basically. But in the general picture, there's a lot of information about these amplitudes. As I mentioned, because of ADS-CFT duality, there's a picture where you have strings propagating on a minimal surface in ADS space. In the strong coupling limit, the amplitude amounts to computing the area of this surface. In various kinematic limits, there are also some exact descriptions, and we use these as boundary conditions to help fix things when we work perturbatively. But there are certain boundary conditions where there's a description in terms of a flux tube, which was developed in part here about 10 years ago by Pedro Vieira and Amit Sever and Benjamin Basso. And we've been developing this perturbative gluon picture by picking particular processes and working them out order by order by making assumptions about the function space that they lie in the multiple polylogarithmic case. And every time we can do it, we either use this as input or we use it as a check. Wherever these flux tube results exist at finite coupling, we can expand them out perturbatively. And then we can go into the kinematic limits and compare. The hope is to combine all these techniques and get some kind of a description that's simultaneously at finite coupling and also for generic kinematics. But that's still to be done. In terms of perturbative amplitudes, one approach is to draw all Feynman graphs and then evaluate all the Feynman rules, which gives you some kind of integrand for each diagram. And then you have to do the hard part, which is performing all the loop integrations. Now, there might be other ways to get the integrand. There's the amplituhedron, or there's evaluating unitarity cuts. There's various ways, other ways to construct local integrands, which might not be decomposed the same way as Feynman diagrams. But still, if you have integrands, you have to integrate them. So for this theory, there's a third approach that works in at least some cases, which we call the bootstrap. And what we do, it's not to be confused with the conformal bootstrap or even the S matrix bootstrap, but it's to guess a set of functions that describe the answer after integrating, and to write down a guess in terms of linear combinations of these functions with unknown rational constants. And then we just have to find enough constraints which come from this boundary data, like the flux tube picture. And then we can, with the boundary information, we can solve for these constants and recover the answer this way. In this way, we never have to do any specific integral, as long as all the integrals belong to the right class. So we've implemented this, as I was mentioning, in the six gluon case, up through seven loops in a series of steps. And we use this boundary data that comes from papers by Basso, Sever, and Vieira. And we use the same general method for the Higgs form factor, which involved boundary data supplied by Tumanoff, Sever, and Wilhelm. The six gluon case, once you use dual conformal invariants, and these variables should have hats on them, it has three variables, U hat, V hat, and W hat. That's actually a pretty rich space. There are many different kinds of limits inside this space that have various factorization properties when you go into those limits that you can also use as tests if you want. One of the things that characterizes this space is that there's a two-dimensional parity-preserving surface. And on this surface, the kinematics collapses, the vectors collapse, momentum vectors collapse to a lower dimensional subspace. And that will be the surface on which we find this duality happening. All of these functions are described by these MPLs, and I sort of gave a generic integral definition earlier, but it's a little more convenient to give a differential definition of them. In the differential definition, every function in this space has a differential, df, which essentially lives in the same space but has one weight lower. So if this has weight n, this f, this quantity here, fsk, it's another iterated integral but with one fewer integration, so weight n minus 1. And then it multiplies a differential with a log of some quantities sk, the symbol letters. And these depend on the underlying variables. And in our problem, there will be six of these letters that depend on a couple of underlying variables. This is actually a piece of a larger Hopf algebra, which in general maps functions to tensor products of functions. In this case, the function on the right is just a weight one function, the logarithm of sk. And so we would write this differential can be recaptured in terms of this Hopf algebra notation, where we split a weight n guy into weight n minus 1 and weight 1. And we have to do a sum over all the letters of the symbol alphabet. So we sometimes call this thing a first coproduct or a n minus 1 comma 1 coproduct. But it's just a way of describing the derivatives of the functions. And notice that the derivatives come at the back of this tensor product. And we can iterate this process to get the full symbol. So we defined fsk by taking the derivative of f. But we can also take the differential of fsj, and we get the same structure. We just put an extra sj on the back to remember that it comes from here. If we keep doing that, we keep building up lower weight transcendental functions until at the very end, at weight n and the nth step, we just get a logarithm of s1, of si1. And so we get this tensor structure where now, just to save space, we remove all the ln's and we just write the tensor products of the letters here. And then this tensor here is just a set of rational numbers. So this is called the symbol, and it was introduced to physicists by Goncharov, Spradlin, Burgu, and Bolovich. So it's a great way of sort of capturing the basic structure of all of these Pauli logarithmic functions. It doesn't capture everything. It loses a lot of constants because you've differentiated all the way down to zero. So if you ever have a zeta function, a Riemann zeta value, say zeta 3, it will get it will disappear. But you can go back and you can do everything in terms of these coproducts, which are differentials, and just keep track of boundary values in order to reconstruct the whole function from the symbol or and a little bit more information. So just as a quick example, the classical polylogs we mentioned earlier, they can be defined as these iterated integrals of the previous classical polylog, and Li1 is just defined to be minus log of 1 minus x. Now, we know that something about the analytic structure of this. It's analytic around the origin. It has a nice regular series expansion, which converges until you hit the branch cut at x equals 1. And if you keep integrating term by term, you get a very similar series. And so the branch cut always starts at x equals 1. If we use this rule here and differentiate it, we see that the differential of ln is ln minus 1 times d log of x. That tells us that in the symbol, we should put the log x at the back and then just ignore the log. So the symbol of ln is the symbol of ln minus 1 tensored with x. If we just iterate this, we get a bunch of x's at the back until we hit Li1 when we get a log of 1 minus x, which we record as this 1 minus x here. So this is the symbol of the classical polylogs, and it displays nicely for you the main analytic properties. The branch cuts are where the first entry vanishes, and in this case, x goes to 1, and the derivatives are computed by looking at the last entry. And this alphabet is this x and 1 minus x. It's actually the same alphabet as for the harmonic polylogs, except that there are way more harmonic polylogs than there are classical polylogs. There is also the symbol alphabets are known, or something about them is known for other n-gluon amplitudes. Like in n equals 6, the case we're going to come back to in a second, there are 9 letters. And these guys are parity odd, and we will get rid of them by working on this parity preserving surface. In the 7-point case, there are 42 letters, and the 8-point case, it's not even known what the total number of letters are, as it seems to keep increasing with loop order, but there are some predictions that it will stabilize. So just kind of heuristically, there's a function space that grows in size as you go up in weight. And each additional one has one more integration. And there are arrows propagating you through this space by taking derivatives or using this coproduct notation. And the whole job is to construct this space as far as you can and find one linear combination of functions within the space that satisfies all the properties of the amplitude or the form factor. And this Higgs case, the kinematics is two-dimensional, as I mentioned earlier. We have these dimensionless ratios, u, v, and w, which sum up to 1. And if we wanted to be in the glue-glue to Higgs scattering kinematics, we would be somewhere in the outer part of this diagram. This would correspond to a space-like tachyonic Higgs mass. For a time-like normal Higgs mass, we'd be over here. And then this would be a Higgs decay region, Higgs to 3 gluons in the middle there. And there's a dihedral symmetry that acts in this space. And that this n equals 4 amplitude is actually invariant under that symmetry, which can be called D3, the symmetries of a triangle, but it's actually isomorphic to S3, total permutations. So again, at one loop, we get this integral, which I wrote down earlier in terms of dilogs. If we rewrite it in terms of these dimensionless ratios, it just looks like this in terms of u and v. If you then use the symbol technology, you get a form that has letters in it, U, 1 minus U, and V, and 1 minus V. But you can also have similar integrals where you cycle 1, 2, and 3 around, and those permute U, V, and W into each other. So the full alphabet you get has these six letters in it. And you should also note that the first entries only involve U and V, and those are related to where branch cuts can appear. At two loops, you get more complicated integrals, but they were all done over 20 years ago. A little over 10 years ago. The amplitude was done. The integrals were done 20 years ago. And the Higgs amplitude was computed. And as mentioned before, it has an array of terms of different transcendental weights. But the top level term happened to have exactly the same structure as the pure weight 4 piece of this of the corresponding chiral stress tensor 3-point form factor. And kind of amazingly, the symbol alphabet was still the same as it was at one loop. So when you see the same thing happen two loops in a row, you think it might happen forever, and it looks like that's probably true. So there are just six letters to worry about in this symbol. Another way of characterizing this is by saying that every derivative with respect to U or V has a simple set of terms, which are all the derivatives of the relevant D-logs with respect to U. So like this 1 over U corresponds to the letter U in the symbol. And this 1 minus W, which is U plus V, comes because 1 minus W depends on U. When you take the U derivative, you see it. So anyway, this is another another way of stating the symbol alphabet. So in order to bootstrap this amplitude beyond the two loops that were done by Brandhuber, Travaglini, and Young, we needed to find as small a subspace of these 2D HPLs as possible, construct it to high weight, and impose various constraints from the OPE. It turns out that it's much nicer for this case if you relabel the symbol alphabet. So this is sort of a birational map, which is a linear transformation of the logarithms of the letters from U, V, W, 1 minus U, 1 minus V, 1 minus W, to A, B, C, D, E, F. And we had tried something like this before in the six gluon case. And when you do it, the symbols simplify quite a lot, become much shorter. So the one loop symbol, for example, has only one term, B tensor D, plus five more terms, which are just dihedral images of this term. And the two loop one has only two terms, plus their dihedral images. And here's the dihedral group represented in these letters. So now the next term is 636 terms, so I'm not going to show you that one. But we could, after computing a few of these, we could see a lot of examples of patterns that every term in the symbol always starts with A, B, and C, and never D, E, or F. And this is actually related to causality. Branch cuts should only appear when Mandelstam variables like PI plus PJ squared go to zero, or maybe the sum of all three. And if you put a D, E, or an F in there, that would lead to a branch cut in an unphysical location. So those guys can never appear in the front. We call that a first entry condition. But then empirically, we also found that 12 pairs of adjacent letters were completely forbidden and never appeared. They're in like two six orbits, so you could say A never appears next to D, and the rest of them come from dihedral symmetries. And you can say D never appears next to E, and the rest come from dihedral symmetries. This actually mystified us a lot. On the six gluon side, we knew there were some similar relations from causality called the Steinman relations, but we didn't see how to derive anything on the three gluon form factor for this. But then once we found this antipodal map on the one-dimensional line, we could lift it off into the whole two-dimensional space. And we found that the generalization of the one-dimensional pattern of HPLs is the following. The form factor, which depends on U, V, and W, where the sum of these three is one, is the antipode map on the symbol of the six gluon amplitude, which depends on U hat, V hat, and W hat. Now, since these are constrained to a two-dimensional surface, these should be two, and they're constrained to this parity-preserving surface. This kinematic map relates the U hats and the U's. Or I guess that's the end. Yeah, sure.
So when you go to two groups,
yeah.
I cross the hate space, so it hates the three block, and then map it to the blue group. Oh, you get, in the case of the standard model or the multi-analysis, you'll sometimes get like minus signs and logs, which is like the vice versa, this sort of thing. So you can kind of like continue.
Yeah.
Is that all forbidden here in these sorts of theories?
There's analytic continuation going on. And like in that triangle, that triangle in the center is in a pseudo-Euclidean region because all the invariants are positive. And so in terms of ratios, it's basically the same as having all of them negative. Thanks for restoring the screen. So there are lots of interesting aspects to your question. This region is pseudo-Euclidean, so almost everything is real here. And then as you cross these lines, you're rotating one of the invariants and switching its sign. Those are discontinuities that are actually captured by these first letters of the symbol by clipping them off. And they tell you how to move across this boundary and pick up all the IPIs. Now, when we come to this duality, the IPIs are all messed up. We have some constants that work that go beyond the symbol level. But this antipode, this Hopf algebra map, the right-hand side is really only defined I pi, because it's kind of like a derivative, like a differential. It doesn't quite have the information about where you're integrating that differential. So there's an I pi ambiguity, which we can't sort out. And we can map various things at the number level, but the moment we get a single I pi, we don't know what we're doing yet. And if we map this over into the three gluon case, as we cross this boundary, we touch an edge of the Euclidean phase space, and then we come back into the Euclidean phase space. We don't know if we're supposed to move to another sheet. That's part of the issue. Anyway, that's there are definitely IPIs that can play a role in all these amplitudes, and we know what all of them are in this plane and in the six gluon side in various regions, but they don't match each other like we might expect from this symmetry. Any other questions? So this is the main sort of statement of the duality, which corresponds in that picture on one page. There's a duality that exchanges two blobs at the bottom, the three gluon form factor and the six gluon amplitude, and this is the more formal statement of it. You take the symbols, and they have two L letters, and you reverse the order of all the letters. And you put in a minus one to the M, but M is always even, so it doesn't matter. So you reverse the order of the letters, but you also have to do a substitution to map between the unhatted and the hatted variables. And this is one way of representing the substitution. And this substitution takes the only physical plane we have for the form factor, and it maps us onto this parity-preserving surface. if we take that map, this map here, we can also apply it at the level of the letters that I defined earlier, A, B, C, D, E, F. And here is the relations again, because we do exactly the same thing with the hats on. And on that parity-preserving surface, these y's all go to 1, which means we can drop them out of the symbol. So we only have 6 letters on each side, which we can take to be A, B, C, D, E, F, A hat, B hat, C hat, D hat, E hat, F hat. And the kinematic map that we're supposed to make on the symbol letters just takes the square root of A hat and maps it to D, and takes D hat and maps it to A, plus cyclic relations. If you take those two formulas I showed you earlier for the 3 gluon form factor, they map into exactly what they're supposed to, of course, on the 6 gluon side. And then we look at the number of terms in the symbol as a function of loop order, and it has this rapidly increasing sequence. And when we first worked this out, we had only 7 loop data on one side. So the number of words that made sense backwards was only 93 million or so. But then I looked up the number of words in the Encyclopedia Britannica, and I found it's only like 40 million or something. So it's like somebody gives you the Encyclopedia Britannica, and then you read it backwards, and it still makes sense. It's kind of surprising. This map covers the entire phase space for the 3 gluon form factor. Here I highlight with these lines the region 1, Euclidean region, and that maps over to some kind of face over here. But it's a little strange in that corners, which are where gluons get soft here, map to lines, which correspond to collinear regions over here. So in various limits, soft is dual to collinear, and collinear is dual to soft. But this surface here maps in here. It's just that the part shown in color maps to that this part of the parity-preserving surface. There's other branches outside the unit cube that the rest of it maps to. Also, I don't have time to go into the details of this OPE formalism, but let me just tell you that there's a natural set of coordinates that these guys use. And U hat, V hat, and W hat, and U, V, and W all look a little bit ugly in the respective variables. But the kinematic map looks quite simple. It just takes T hat to T over S, S hat to 1 over TS, and then the inverse map looks exactly the same except with square roots. So that's quite intriguing. But in order to try to understand what was going on, we would like to have at least one more example. And we originally thought that this 4 gluon form factor might be connected to the 6 gluon, the 8 gluon amplitude, but we were wrong. After we were able to compute it, we discovered it was really connected in a different way. This 4 gluon form factor is quite a bit more complicated than the 3 gluon form factor. It depends on 5 different kinematical variables instead of just 2. And we had a lot of help from our friends here who were doing QCD higher loop computations, and they had been working out systematically, one by one, the 2 loop graphs with 1 external massive leg for this operator and 4 massless legs, some of which are shown here. And we learned from their papers and some private communications that there were 113 possible symbol letters. So we put those letters into some machinery for constructing these functions. And then we looked in that weight for space and we found a single answer. It was actually enough just to use the collinear limits. That uniquely determined this symbol. And then we could also check it in a triple collinear limit. This triple collinear limit is a bit strange, but it's actually a universal property. And this 6 gluon amplitude is actually, because of dual conformal symmetry, the same as it is in the triple collinear limit. It doesn't actually move you anywhere because of this symmetry. And that's why it becomes equivalent to this A6. So Oh, we checked one other limit too against a recent computation. When this operator is light-like, that was computed in this case. And then we discovered when we had this two-loop answer that we could map it into itself by we found a kinematic map which did all the right things and expressed in terms of some OPE variables. You'll notice it looks almost exactly the same as the previous map. It's just that now these variables, T, S, T2, and S2, they all describe the kinematics here. Whereas in the previous case, we had variables T hat and T over S, and some of them were describing the 6-gluon amplitude, and some of them were describing the 3-gluon form factor. But the fact that these maps are the same, it ensures that when you go into these two limits, you map into the other ones correctly. So we've computed this first at two loops and discovered the kinematic map for this symmetry. And more recently, we've used the same alphabet to bootstrap the symbol at one loop further at three loops. Whereas the two-loop symbol actually only makes use of 34 of these letters, the three-loop symbol uses 88 of them. And we find that this antipodal self-duality also holds it at three loops. So now we're pushing on to four loops, but four loops is a very big calculation with some high-dimension system of linear equations, so we try to make a few assumptions first. We assume that since 113 letters, which was only guaranteed to be the answer at two loops, since it also worked at three loops, we assume it's going to work at four loops. And then if we also assume this antipodal self-duality, then we find we can only use 93 of the 113 letters because the other 20 map somewhere else under this map. So that's what we're doing now to try to flesh this out some more, is to look at this for loop one, but at the same time, we want to inspect various regions of the kinematics to see if they'll give us any more clues about why this symmetry holds. So let me just say that that we can now bootstrap form factors as well as scattering amplitudes in some cases to very high loop order. We found first this strange duality between these two guys, which was then embedded in a 4-gluon form factor self-duality. But we still have no real understanding of where this came from. Seems like it should come from some properties of these flux tube excitations, but we haven't really done a serious investigation of it. It ought to say some things about strong coupling, where there are minimal surface computations you can do and compare things in the different kinematics that are suggested by these kinematic maps. That hasn't been looked at yet. And we would like to know what other theories might it hold in. Is there some residue of it that holds in QCD? We have very small hints, but nothing very definite yet. And there's also the question of, in general, how much can we exploit this duality to learn more about both amplitudes and form factors? So I'll stop there. Thanks a lot.
Can I ask one question?
Hi, Pedro.
Oh, hi, Lance. So I remember at some point there was a similar story about reading things from one direction and the other direction in correlation functions when you consider single-valued functions. Is it true?
Yeah, it's true that the rule for constructing a real analytic function of a complex variable involves this same antipode map. So if you, the simplest case, you just have one complex variable and you have punctures at 0, 1, and infinity. So you have like log of z squared is a good function, magnitude squared, because it doesn't pick up a branch cut. And more generally, Francis Brown gave a construction of these, which uses this antipode map. In other words, the function that you need in z bar involves the antipode of the function you started with in Z. So that would be great if we could figure out where the complex variable is lurking and the single-valuedness. Now, we don't know where it is in general, but maybe if we go into the multi-regi limit, we could learn something, because there it's manifest that you involve these single-valued functions. Does that answer?
Could it be that, maybe a place to also explore could be these two-dimensional amplitudes?
You consider ADS3, you mean two-dimensional kinematics?
Yes.
Yeah, we looked a little bit at some 8 points in 2D, and we didn't succeed, but other things worked out first, so we kind of dropped it in midstream, and there might be something there. It's a good point. I should also mention that this antipode map shows up in some work on, for example, one loop integrals in of n-gons in d equals n over 2 or something like that. N-gons in n dimensions, I guess. So those there's a kind of antipode map you can do there and recast the thing. But when you do that map, the kinematic map that you're instructed, at least in the version that Nima Arkani Hamid and Ellis Yuan gave, it seems to move you off of the surface of massless internal lines. So like, there's the Bloch-Wigner function, which is the four-mass box integral, and that maps into another integral under an antipode map, but it has massive internal lines. So it doesn't seem to be the same thing as what we have here.
I see, okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Thanks for the talk.
Any other questions from the audience? If you have other questions, next, then call the speaker.